South of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, so let's get started. First, I'd like to mention that a lot of you have noticed that I've changed my theme song. Well, not actually the theme song, but the singer. Most people who emailed me about it liked that I shuffled things around a bit. But they want to know who the singer is. And only two or three people guessed it. It's a very young Dean Martin from about 1949. A little salsa music, you know? A little salsa the border. So that was Dean Martin, pre-Rat Pack. Back when he and Jerry Lewis were still the world's most famous and most highly paid comedy team. That was way back when they were still buddies. And I'll bet you never knew, at their peak in the mid-50s, Martin and Lewis were making today's equivalent of $1 million a performance, which was about $150,000 a night back then. And getting a little off the subject here, when I hear things like that, when somebody quotes or I read about salary figures from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, I really get angry at the government, and you should get mad too. Especially when I hear Americans around my age say things like this. Yeah, my dad was a machinist at Chrysler in 1970, and I remember he made $12,000 a year, which would be the equivalent of maybe 60 or 70 grand today. People like to talk nostalgically about that stuff, but they should really get pissed off. That's direct proof of a terrible debasement of the money supply. And who's to blame? The Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, of course. They probably planned it that way. Anyway, when I hear people relate those stories back and forth at parties and get-togethers and just over a cup of coffee, talking about how really inexpensive things used to be in the States when they were kids or when their parents were young, I just can't believe how passive most Americans are. I mean, when somebody says in 1970, $12,000 was like 60 or 70 grand today, why doesn't that get people mad? What more proof do you need? That your government has so screwed up the monetary system that there's been 500% inflation since 1970? When people talk about how back then gas was like 75 cents a gallon of milk was 40 cents, or a pair of nice leather shoes was $8, they talk about it nostalgically. I just don't get it. But I know you PRN and Expat File listeners are getting it, or you wouldn't be listening to this. You'd be watching Dancing with the Stars. Anyway, speaking of nostalgia, in my own case, I'll never forget back in about 1975, when my dad actually was making 12 grand a year, and on that was able to support his family of six kids. I remember asking him back then what he thought a terrific salary was, how much money a guy would have to earn per year to know in his heart that he'd really made it in the world, that he was really a success. And you know what my dad said? He said, if you ever make your age, that's when you're sitting on top of the world. Now, at that time, my dad was about 40 years old. $12,000 a year at that time was perfectly adequate for a middle-class family. But according to his logic, if he'd have been making his age, 40 grand a year, he would have been sitting on top of the world. And today, 40 grand a year for a family? That's only slightly above the poverty line. Now, doesn't that make you mad? Well, it should. And by the way, while we're talking about it, what's your idea of sitting on top the world salary-wise? $200,000-$300,000 a year? You know, when first world people tell me that if they made $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 a year up in the first world, they'd be on easy street, I just have to laugh. Because you know what? Even on that kind of money, you still couldn't afford a full-time live-in maid. I guarantee you. Why? Because you'd be in the 50% tax bracket. That's why. And don't go telling me the top federal bracket is 35%. Because once you add state, federal, sales tax, and property tax, you're well over 50%. Maybe even more than 50%. So the problem is, because you live up in the first world, your earning power is cut automatically in half by taxes. But that's another story. Suffice it to say, you'd have to be making $500,000 a year or more to have a full-time live-in maid up there. But the fact is, down here in Latin America, off the tourist trail, nearly every expat family man I know has a full-time live-in maid. even expats living on as little as $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year. And that's because down here, you pay a live-in maid only about $150 to $250 a month. But you listen to the expat file, so you already know that. Oh, yeah, that reminds me. I forgot to tell you. If you go to my website, expatwisdom.com, you'll notice there's a link for my upcoming seminar in January 2013. And you also might notice that there's a link for a couple of my expat wisdom seminars to be held in Spain. And that's something completely new. But what's that all about? Well, it's like this. By now, you must all realize that the euro is crashing, the European Union is falling apart, and they have terrifically high unemployment. In fact, in Spain, the government statistics say it's 25% amongst adults, which means it's probably more like 35 or 40% because you know how governments lie. Anyway, Europe has fallen so deep into the crapper, even deeper than the U.S., that businessmen and investors there are panicking. They know the euro is going to crash and that the whole continent is on its way into a huge depression, bigger and deeper than anything they've ever seen before. And smart European businessmen and investors want a way out. They want a life raft, a way to preserve their lifestyles, their businesses, and their investments before it's too late. And guess what? They've been thinking about Latin America as the perfect life raft, especially Spanish businessmen and investors, because they've got a leg up in that they know the language, naturally. Anyway, by hook and crook, a group of businessmen and attorneys in Spain discovered the expat files. And they know now about my Expat Wisdom Insider Seminar in Latin America. And they've invited me and my team to Europe to give a few presentations. And since the first few will be in Spain, the link to these seminars on the Expat Wisdom website page is in Spanish. Naturally. So I'm not trying to confuse anyone. I'm just putting up the link in Spanish for those European Spaniards. Okay, enough about that. As you guys who listen regularly to the show know, I talk quite a bit about sanitation and cleanliness down here in Latin America because Latin standards in that respect are quite a bit lower than ours. That's why so many gringo travelers and expats often come down with stomach and intestinal maladies on a regular basis. 20 plus years ago when I first came down, the same thing happened to me. But you live and learn. And I learned real fast that I needed to have my own water purification system in my house, and I needed to have a nice, portable, indestructible unit every time I traveled, too. Now, ever since I described my own personal water purification system about a year and a half ago on the show, since then I've had a lot of requests from people asking me how to put one together themselves. And I did write up a description and make a diagram of the system, available for free if you just go to expatwisdom.com. It's a three-canister under-the-counter system with the first standard canister being a cheap $5 or $6 sediment filter that removes particles, dust, rusts, and slime and stuff. And the second filter is the workhorse. It's a high-tech ceramic filter that costs around $25 to $35 that filters down to a half a micron. And the third and last filter is a solid carbon block filter that also filters down to about a half a micron. And that filter runs about $15 or $20. Now, a lot of people who I've sent the diagram to have asked me if it filters out fluoride. Well, first of all, I can tell you that down here in Latin America, I don't have to filter out fluoride because no one but no one adds it to their water supply. Although a lot of municipal supplies and private wells dump ungodly amounts of chlorine in theirs. And it seems to be totally arbitrary. And since this is Latin America, and governments can't even keep the municipal water flowing 24 hours a day, how can you expect them to regulate the amount of chlorine that goes into your water? So once again, expats, it's something you have to take into your own hands again. And by the way, there is no safe amount of chlorine in your water anyway. It's a 100% pure biotoxin, just like fluorine or fluoride. Your body has no use for it at all. In fact, it only damages cells it comes in contact with. I mean, let's face it, that's why they put chlorine in water. It kills microorganisms and kills them indiscriminately. And what are you made out of? Well, you're made up of trillions of organized microorganisms called cells. And they die on contact with chlorine and fluorine, just like the bad bugs do. And when given in very low doses, like they are in the water supplies, they linger around the interstitial fluids throughout your body and cause undetermined amount of damage and destruction depending on the concentration. And when it comes to fluoride and chlorine, no amount is safe, really. But at least, down here in Latin America, they don't add fluorine. Thank God, because they'd be as reckless about it as they are with adding chlorine to municipal supplies. And why do I say reckless? That's because I've seen some articles lately in big Latin newspapers reporting that when chemists check the concentration of fluoride coming out of the faucet of a municipal supply, some days it's absolutely undetectable, and other days it's 40 parts per million, which the FDA in the U.S. says is 10 times the advisable safe limit. So what does that mean? That just means no one's minding the store down at the municipal water plant. Chances are there's a guy down there at the plant in charge of putting in the chlorine in manually because the automatic chlorinator is busted. Remember what I said about Latins and maintenance? Not to mention, chlorine gas and chlorine in pellet form, like sodium hypochlorite, are some of the most corrosive chemicals known to man. So the chlorinators themselves don't last that long, even when they're maintained first world style. You know what happens when household bleach touches anything metallic, don't you? And that's only about a 2 to 5% solution. Anyway, you can just bet that on any given day at a Latin American municipal water building, there's a guy manually adding chlorine, a guy with probably zero chemistry background, who sometimes simply forgets to add chlorine and sometimes adds way too much. And you can bet that Mondays are particularly spotty, since Monday is tequila hangover day. But seriously, actually I was serious. Anyway, no matter what rumors you hear or what you read in the paper about how you can drink the water in some particular Latin city, don't fall for it. Do not, I repeat, do not drink the tap water. And you know, I've heard from a lot of people, expats included, that tell me, "Hey Johnny, do you know you can drink the water in Costa Rica and you can drink the water in Panama? What with all the tourists, they're really up to date with that stuff now." You even see signs now in hotels and airports to that effect. Maybe if you're a street dog or a cow, it's okay. But I repeat, no matter what you read or hear, don't drink the water out of the tap. And I admit, you'll be tempted sometimes because locals drink it out of the tap. They do it all the time. But just remember, up in the United States, the federal and municipal governments insist you can drink the water out of the tap there, don't they? But really, only the undereducated and underinformed drink it. And if you really did trust your government, you wouldn't be listening to this program now, would you? Anyway, just one more thing about chlorine, since they can really pour it on down here. Now, the U.S. Federal Safe Drinking Guideline is that municipal water supplies are supposed to have between 1 and 3 parts per million of chlorine in the water. And here's the thing you should remember. Even the U.S. federal government guidelines say you should not drink water with 4 parts per million chlorine or more in it. But here's the catch-22. Did you know that the average person cannot smell chlorine in the water until it reaches 4 parts per million? Well, you know what that means then, don't you? Every time you pour a glass of water and it smells like chlorine, well, that means there's more than 4 parts per million chlorine in your water supply. And that violates federal standards. And up in the States, all of us have smelled chlorine in our water, haven't we? Which only reinforces the fact that you should never drink municipal water in the States either. But back to my water filtration system. Like I said, I get emails all the time from people asking me if it removes fluoride. First of all, my system has a carbon block filter, which is very good at taking out the chlorine. It also drastically reduces lead and mercury, organics, pesticides and pesticide byproducts, fertilizer residues and pharmaceutical impurities that may have leaked into the supply. Solid carbon block filters are terrific at removing that kind of stuff. But fluoride is a different thing altogether. And it's obvious that when people ask me if my system removes fluoride, they're not asking me that because they're going to come down and use it in Latin America. There is no fluoride down here. They're asking that because they want to use it up in Cleveland. Now listen carefully. The first two stages of my filter, the sediment filter followed by the ceramic filter, they remove particles, sediment, slime, rust, dust, amoeba, bacteria, protozoa, and Clostrosporidium cysts. Remember that outbreak that killed some people in Milwaukee some years ago? Well, any 0.5 micron filter would have taken care of that problem. But the second stage, the carbon filter, does all the heavy lifting on the organics that might be in your water. The pesticides, fertilizer residues, and chemicals and stuff. And it removes the chlorine. And for people who say that a carbon block filter won't take out the fluorine or fluoride, or a big percentage of it, obviously you didn't show up or you snoozed off in your chemistry class while they were discussing the periodic table of the elements. Remember that? Because if you were paying attention, you'd remember that fluorine and chlorine are in the same column right next to each other. That means they have very similar chemical properties. Chlorine and fluorine are in the same family, just like gold, silver, and platinum are in the same family and in the same column, with very similar electrical and chemical properties. Just like you have the gases helium, neon, and argon in the same column. They too have very similar properties. So what I'm saying is fluorine and chlorine are so similar that what happens to chlorine chemically has to happen to fluorine too. So bottom line, does my system pull out fluorine? A chemist friend of mine says it should reduce the fluoride concentration by 20 to 60%. And he said if you put another carbon filter in series with that, use two carbon block filters, that should knock fluoride down by 90%. Or you could add another filter in series specifically for fluoride. And I've done a little homework on that for you. If you go to the website www.pure-earth.com, you could buy a fluoride filter that fits right into one of those standard canisters. By the way, I use those cheap generic Culligan or Amtec canisters. You can get them at Ace Hardware or Home Depot or practically any plumbing supply store for 20 bucks or so. So if you specifically want the fluoride out of your water, go to their website and buy one of their filters and stick it in a canister. Obviously for use up in the States because you don't need it down here. Anyway, one of these fluoride filters will cost you about 40 to 50 bucks and last you about a year. But also notice on this website they sell their own carbon block filter too. And guess what? It says it removes fluoride. So don't let anybody tell you that a carbon block filter does not take out fluoride. Just go to this website, www.pure-earth.com, and it'll tell you everything you want to know about fluoride and getting rid of it. And by the way, did you know that Hitler put fluoride in the water in the concentration camps? Because it makes people calm, docile, and easily manipulated. Go ahead and look it up. You'll see I'm right. And by the way, that website even sells a giant fluoride filter that takes the fluoride out of all the water in your house. In case you're worried about fluoride penetrating your skin or lungs during a shower. But personally, I think it's overkill. Just treat your drinking water and get rid of the fluoride toothpaste and mouthwash. And just a disclaimer here, I have absolutely nothing to do with that company, nor do I make money if you go there or click on the links. Just giving you some good info, that's it. Now, on a similar note, I'm sure you've noticed that in past shows, I've talked quite a bit about sanitation and cleanliness when going to restaurants down here in Latin America. I've given you some advice and laid out some simple precautions so that you can easily avoid Montezuma's revenge and other nasty intestinal bugs that us first worlders just aren't used to. Now, if you've been listening to and actually following all the pointers I've been giving, you're probably as healthy as I am. I've only been sick one time in the last 6 years, and that was with the flu. Nothing serious. And remember, I'm deep in the heart of the rough and tumble third world here, off the sanitized gringo track. Yet I don't get sick. Anyway, as you regular listeners already know, I gave my recommendations about cleanliness and sanitation regarding bathrooms in restaurants in some detail in my past shows. Now it's time I cover some of the more delicate things in that regard. I always suggest every chance you get, swipe a few paper napkins from any restaurant you happen to be in. Always have a few in your pocket. They'll come in handy. That way, when you're in a public bathroom and you find out there's no toilet paper at all, well, you get the idea. And if you have a couple little paper napkins in your pocket, when you're leaving the bathroom, you won't have to touch the handle, which is probably the most fecally contaminated thing in the whole place. But obviously, there are going to be times you have to use the bathroom and you don't have a paper napkin or two. So what do you do then? Well, that's simple. You just wait around a minute or two and someone's bound to leave or come in. And when they crack the door open, you won't have to touch the handle at all. But you won't be able to slip out that easily. You'll have to grab the door somewhere to prop it open. And my suggestion? Grab the door in a place that people normally never touch, like high up about head level on the inside edge. And if you're standing and waiting a long time and no one's coming in and out, just grab the top of the door where the closing mechanism is and pull on it and you'll be able to jack open the door. Easy, huh? And I guarantee you that's a place that no one ever touches. So if you take those little precautions, you won't have to grab a doorknob or a handle that was in intimate contact with the last dozen or so butthole surfers. It'll definitely lower your own personal bacteria count and give you peace of mind. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of using your foot instead of your hand anywhere inside of a public bathroom, including nudging the door open when you enter. Now, lest you think I'm overdoing the bathroom sanitation and cleanliness bit, you're about to get a completely new perspective next time you sit on that porcelain goddess. Okay, now think of this for a second. After you've done your business and you've used the requisite amount of toilet paper, and you put that Men's Health or Victoria's Secret magazine back into the magazine rack, one question, what do you do next? Why, you pull up your pants and fasten your belt, of course. And what hand did you do that with? Now, if you take a few seconds to put some thought into this, you have to realize that's a completely unsanitary, if not disgusting, maneuver to do. But it's gotta be done, right? And the only plausible solution to that would be, before you pull your pants up and do your belt, you grab another piece of toilet paper and then put yourself back together. Now, let me ask you, is there one person in 100,000 who's got that routine down? It takes a lot of practice to get it right. Now, in mentioning this, I'm not trying to gross you out here, but obviously, no matter how cautious and careful you think you are, there's an undeniable flaw in the process, and that, of course, is when you pull your pants up and put yourself back together again. Now, if there's anyone out there who can think of a simple, easy alternative method, send me an email and we'll tell the world. I mean, someone somewhere has to have worked this thing out. Or not. And here's another bathroom etiquette problem that's always puzzled me. Humans, of course, are the only people that use toilet paper, right? Eddie says that the French don't, but that might just be a rumor. Anyway, when you think about it, why should we need toilet paper at all? Do we have some kind of genetically imperfect plumbing or something? I doubt it. No other animals do. And of course, we know why we need it. That's not the point. Is it because of our diets? I mean, other animals, squirrels, dogs, horses, even great apes and chimpanzees that have 97% of our own genetic code. They don't use toilet paper. They never will and they never did. I can't believe we have a design flaw in our backsides. That doesn't seem possible. It's gotta be diet. I mean, what did prehistoric man use? Or pre-Columbian Indian tribes? What'd they use, if anything? Now, there's a great subject for an anthropology master's thesis. And I'm sure a paper like that would go viral on the internet. It's not something you want to think about too long, but it is a puzzle now, isn't it? But let's move on. Now, I know a lot of you listeners out there are getting bombarded with a lot of information from websites about buying gold and silver and storing food and guns and ammo. Basically, the prepper thing has gone viral on the internet. Even my email sites have been penetrated. Every day I get some kind of report from some survivalist guru about how my rights have been eroded and how the government's setting up FEMA camps, about how to survive when the grid goes down, how to live off the land if there's an EMP strike, how to store water and seeds and reload your ammo. And sometimes I do click on the link and read this stuff, and all I can think of is 10 or 15 years ago, this stuff just didn't exist. Now you got dozens of survivalist and prepper websites, and Alex Jones, of course. You even got Bill Gates talking about depopulating the world. And seriously, if you or I followed their advice and had a year's supply of food, water, ammo, medicine, diesel, and had a couple of generators, well, when the next crisis comes, whether it be financial, anarchy, war, or otherwise, there's going to be 50 other houses in my neighborhood, each with a couple of kids, who didn't prepare at all, and who now, after a few days without food and water, would slit my throat for a Hershey bar and a Coke. So to me, the whole damn prepper movement is ass backwards. I mean, when the feces hits the rotors, and believe me, I have no doubt that it will within the next year or two, you're going to be the only house in the neighborhood with lights. And after a few weeks, it's going to be like the zombie apocalypse. Even if you have perimeter sensors, barbed wire, electric fence, and dogs, what are you going to do when the zombie mob rushes your house? You going to shoot them? You going to shoot your neighbors? And here's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. The other day I was listening to some super prepper on Alex Jones saying, yeah, when paper money's no good and the ATMs don't work anymore because the banking system's down, the best bartering tools won't be gold and silver because even an old silver dime or quarter will have so much value that conversion into stable goods like food will be difficult. Instead, this prepper guru advised that the best bartering tool of all will be common caliber ammo. And he's right. That'll be money. That'll be good as gold. So now I'm thinking, yeah, the crash comes and I got all this ammo. And let's say I barter a box of 22 long rifle shells for a chainsaw. Well, duh, as soon as I hand him over that box of shells, he's going to shoot me in the head and take everything I've got. History shows that when chaos reigns, ethics and morality go right down the tubes. You think you got stress now? Just wait till you're the only one in the neighborhood who's got food and water. And then tell me you're going to be able to sleep at night, especially if you got kids in the house. And we all know this is going to come eventually. So isn't that the greatest reason in the world to come down to Latin America? Down here, nobody's ever even heard of a prepper. There's no Spanish word for it. It's not in their vocabulary. Looks to me that the only way you're going to ever live a reasonably normal life is to get your ass down here to Latin America as soon as you possibly can arrange it. Then you won't have to worry about food and shelter and energy. It's just not an issue. In the rainy season, you get so much fresh water, you can't store it. You've got 3 or 4 growing seasons a year, and because of the intense sun, the vegetables and fruits are so huge and healthy, if you got just a couple of fruit trees in your backyard, you won't be able to give the stuff away fast enough. I've got a couple of fruit and avocado trees myself, and I've had that problem many a time. Every expat I know who's got any kind of garden at all either gives most of it away or it rots. And if you're in the Altiplano like me, above 3,000 feet in elevations, you never need heating or air conditioning. So what do you prep for? And even in a crisis, if gas goes to $10, $15, $20 a gallon or it's not available at all you need is a couple of solar panels and a solar hot water heater, and you're completely off the grid. So I'm asking you, do you want to be a prepper up in the first world, preparing for that zombie apocalypse? Or do you think you and your kids just might have a little bit better quality of life down here in Latin America? And I know all you wannabes listening to the show are thinking about doing that. But you have to know you don't have all the time in the world. The clock is ticking. Now, I'm not saying if you move to Latin America, you don't have to prepare for the worst. Because when it does hit the fan up in Europe and in the States, we're going to hear about it down here right away too. But I can tell you one thing, down here, no one's going to panic. No one's going to go for the gun. What are you going to do up in Cleveland when your power goes out for weeks at a time and winter's coming on? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to fix a nice cup of coffee and watch the parrots and the toucans raid my avocado and mango trees. Don't you hate when they do that? And what about the local Latin population down here? The ones who make $300 a month? You wonder, what are they going to do when the first world collapses? What are they going to do when gas is $10 or $15 a gallon? Are they going to grab their machetes and riot in the streets or go after the rich gringos and storm their houses? Well, like expat Eddie says, and he's kind of a white trash philosopher, you know? He says the common Latins won't riot. Things won't change much at all. Because it's awful easy to get by on what you never had.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture. He knows.